You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Research and Innovation here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you here today for our special lunchtime event. I'm really pleased to introduce today's speaker, Helen Pearson, to RSA House. Helen is a science journalist and editor for the international science journal Nature. She's been writing for Nature since 2001, and her stories have won accolades, including the 2010 WeStar International Science Journalism Award and two Best Features Award from the Association of British Science Writers. Helen has a degree in natural sciences from the University of Cambridge and a PhD in genetics, which I think would have given her the interest to study these lives in the depth that she has in this book. Today she's going to be looking deeply into her book, The Life Project, which tells us what data can tell us about human lives. The talk's going to look at the extraordinary stories that human lives over the last 70 years and give us an overview of unique studies that have tracked generations of children since the war and have brought about some really incredible insights. Things about inequalities at birth, inequalities at school, smoking and pregnancy, and social mobility, just to name a few. I'm really looking forward to hearing about the data, but also the real social histories that come out in this work. So please join me in welcoming Helen Pearson.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for inviting me to talk here today, and thank you very much for coming and listening. It's really a pleasure to be here. So as Rowan said, my book is about a remarkable series of studies which have tracked generations of children growing up in Britain over the last 70 years and what they've taught us about why we walk different paths in life. So why are some of us successful to some extent and some of us struggle much more? And today I want to tell you a little bit about these studies, how I came to write this book about them, and then I'm also going to pull out just a few of the key findings which have emerged from them over the years and what they've really shown us about science and about society. And my main message today really is that remarkable things happen when we do something as simple as track people through their lives, and I hope I can convince you of that. So the story starts back in March 1946 when scientists recorded the birth of almost every baby that was born in 1 week. This was just a few months after the end of the war. And they've been following thousands of them ever since and collecting all kinds of information about their health, their development, their income, their jobs, and much, much more. And those people turned 70 in March, and perhaps you might have seen that birthday celebrated on the news. And this has become something special. It's now the longest-running detailed study of human development in the world. So the people in that study are really some of the best-studied people on the planet. And this study of them was so successful that scientists did it again. So this is just a timeline of these five studies. So they started following thousands of children born in 1 week in 1958. They did it again in 1970. They started a fourth study in the early 1990s, again following thousands of children, and then once again at the turn of the millennium. And altogether, there are over 70,000 people who've been enrolled in these studies now across those five generations. And these are called birth cohort studies, and a birth cohort is just a group of people who were born at around the same time. And no other country in the world is following generations of children in quite this way and in quite this detail. And these studies have really amassed mountains of information, so many thousands of paper questionnaires, terabytes worth of computer data, freezers full of DNA and urine and blood samples and much, much more. And that data has become very valuable for scientists. The findings have, by my estimate, produced something like 6,000 academic papers and books over the years. And they have fed into policies around pregnancy, birth, schooling, social mobility, adult education, and much, much more, and shaped scientists' understanding of many types of issues, ranging through fetal development, chronic disease, and aging. And I argue in the book that because of this, these studies have really touched the lives of almost everyone in Britain today. Now, that's also why these studies have become the envy of scientists around the world. So sometimes people call them a jewel in the crown of British science. And before I go into them in a little bit more detail, I just want to mention how I came across these studies and came to write this book. So this was about 5 years ago. I was working as a journalist and an editor for the journal Nature, which is what I do now. I was really interested in just finding good stories we could tell about science and about people. And I really stumbled on the website of this first cohort born in 1946. And I ended up writing a feature story about that study for Nature. This was in 2011. And as part of that, I attended a birthday party for this group, because they were turning 65 at the time, which was a real milestone for them and for the study. And it was a very unusual event to be in this room full of people who all shared a birthday in the same week, and they were all having a fantastic time. And it really struck me there that this was such a special bunch of people, and this was such an extraordinary story, actually, that someone really ought to write it as a book. And I actually just couldn't believe someone hadn't already written this book. So since then, I've really spent every scrap of my spare time researching these studies and writing that book. And it's really been an amazing journey. I've carried out well over 150 interviews with scientists, with science administrators and funders, and also with a few cohort members as well. Now, you might think that if Britain had a world-leading series of studies like this, we'd have made sure that they were well looked after, well organised. The government would obviously ensure that they had plenty of financial support through the years. However, that's not quite how it's been. So I discovered that these stories actually have a dramatic and wonderfully British story. They've been run by a cast of eccentric English men and women over the years, and often it's really been on a wing and a prayer. There have been many times when one or other of these studies have been just a step away from collapse. And that was just because scientists weren't really sure if they could get the financial and political support that they needed to keep these things on the road. And I also found in my research that these remarkably few people had really heard about these studies, or the ones that I spoke to, obviously beyond the scientists who run them, and that the story hadn't really been pieced together before for a wider audience. And that was really my goal in writing the book, was to tell the remarkable story of these studies and also these scientists who'd struggled to keep them alive over the years. So with that introduction, I'm just going to tell you now about four of the key findings which have emerged over the years around birth, around schooling, around smoking, and about inequality, each of which has ended up having quite a major impact on policy. And so the first of these is all around birth. So this is one of the babies born into the very first cohort with his mother in 1946. And actually, one of my favourite parts of this story is actually the very start of this first cohort study. So the backstory is that it all started actually before the war and during, when there were concerns that women in Britain just weren't having enough babies. The birth rate had been falling, and the concern was that if women didn't have more babies, then there wouldn't be enough people born to sustain and rule the British Empire, which was very big at the time. And some academics actually warned that if women didn't have more babies, then the British would go extinct. Now, there was lots of discussion about this, and eventually it was decided that the best way to find out why women weren't having babies was to go out and talk to them. So to do this, scientists asked health visitors to go out and interview every single mother who had given birth to a baby in this one week that I mentioned in March 1946. And this was across England and Scotland and Wales. And this was an incredibly ambitious exercise, which would be almost impossible today, but it was pulled off with a kind of post-war panache, and they reached over 90% of these mothers, which is about 14,000 babies. Now, I really love the fact that despite this being this huge survey about fertility and birth rate, none of these women were asked anything about sex, because that was just considered to be off the table at the time. But it is really interesting to look back at these questionnaires, samples of them, and see what the women were asked. And they were asked things like this. Were you able to get your full extra ration of a pint of milk a day? Who looked after your husband while you were in bed with this baby? How much did you spend on vests, petticoats, booties, bonnets, shawls, knickers, and rubber sheets for baby? And how much did you spend on smocks, corsets, nightdresses, knickers, and brassieres for yourself? Now, you know, those questions really speak to their moment in time, but they proved to be really important. So they collected up all these questionnaires and all this data, and by the time they got all of this in, these original concerns about the birth rate had disappeared because, of course, the baby boom was taking off. So the original aim of the study became somewhat moot, but it turned out to be important in another way. So these questions about how much women spent on vests and petticoats and so on turned out to be important because it revealed how much it actually cost to have a baby. And it was no surprise to me to learn that it actually costs an arm and a leg to have a baby, but in that time, no one had really done this in any detail before, and of course it cost an arm and a leg then as well. But the important thing was that scientists found that these costs were much harder for the working class families to afford. It was taking a much bigger bite out of their income, so it exposed some of the inequalities in society. And it also showed that in another way. So it showed that working class mothers were receiving much worse medical care during pregnancy than those in the middle and upper classes, and that their babies were 70% more likely to be born dead. And the obvious reason for this was that the poor families couldn't afford good medical care, because this was before the days of the NHS, so women got the medical care they could afford, and if they couldn't afford it, then they went without. So these findings attracted a lot of attention when they were published in the late 1940s, but despite these rather depressing messages about inequality, they also emerged at just the right time, because this was just as the welfare state and the NHS was being put together. And so these findings were able to feed into the foundations of the NHS, and when the NHS emerged or was launched in 1948, the care around pregnancy and birth became free for everybody. And also around that time, more generous maternity benefits were introduced. So this survey really helped create this lasting belief that pregnant women deserve support from the state, and it really means that the maternity leave and benefits which parents receive today is partly thanks to this survey back in 1946. And that's one reason I argue in the book that these studies have touched the lives of almost everyone in the country today. And that I also like that story because it just shows how collecting these relatively mundane details about people's lives, you know, how much they spent on bras and corsets and so on, can really reveal important truths about what society is really like. And I say in the book that the cohort studies are sometimes like holding a mirror up to Britain, and sometimes we don't like what we see. So we see inequality, for example, reflected back at us very often. I'm going to move on to the second big finding I wanted to pull out. Okay, so that was David Ward, that's the baby. Here he is as a little boy now, looking very cute. So the second thing I wanted to talk about is studies which emerged as these children grew up, and it was around our schooling system. So after this first survey, scientists decided that they would continue to follow this original group of children on into their lives and collect data on them as they went. But because they actually didn't have the computing power to follow all of them, they whittled that original 14,000 children down to about 5,000, and that's how many they've kept following. And it turned out that this study offered a very powerful way to test whether the 11 plus exam was working. Now, that exam was introduced as part of the 1944 Education Act, and it was supposed to be an equaliser within schooling. So the idea was that the cleverest children would all pass the 11 plus and get to the elite grammar schools regardless of their social background or their class. Now, the cohort study actually showed that the 11 plus exam wasn't working the way that it should. So it revealed that bright children from the working classes were far less likely to do well at school and were less likely to pass the 11 plus exam than were equally bright children from the middle and upper classes. Now, this finding made quite a big splash when it was released in the 1960s, and this failure of smart but poor children to get into grammar schools and became known as the waste of talent. And this is a headline in a newspaper from the time, Britain's squandered treasury of talent, and the subhead reads, "A well-researched book today shatters any conceptions of a classless society and focuses attention on the thousands of schoolchildren who will never have a chance." Now, that book it refers to was called The Home and the School. It contained these cohort results, and it really became something of a kind of must-read educational reference for teachers in training, social workers in training, and a lot of people actually remember that book still. Now, that study also went on and fed into policy and politics, and in 1965, the year after this book was published, that was when the Labour government drove through a massive expansion of the comprehensive schools, which were designed to replace the 11-plus exam and the selective school system with a more one-size-fits-all approach. And obviously today we have a little bit of a patchwork still. But because of all this, I think, you know, we can say that as well as shaping the way that we give birth, these cohort studies also went on to shape our education system and the way that many of us have been schooled. Of course, I'm sure you know that the debate about whether selective education or comprehensive education is better for children is just as fierce now as it was when this was being published in the 1960s. So, moving on again, This is, again, David Ward, the cohort member I showed you. Here he has grown up now with his own children. And one of the interesting things about these studies is the way that the questions that scientists ask of them change over time. And obviously part of that is because the people in them grow up, so we want to know different things about them. We can't ask about schooling once they've grown up. But they also reflect the way that society has changed and that the interests of scientists have changed as well. And one great example of that is around smoking in pregnancy. So I'm going to show you here a poster which was produced as a result of results which emerged from these studies and just explain how that came to be. So it's really interesting, actually, that when the first cohort study was done, this was the 1946 one, no one thought to ask the women whether they smoked in pregnancy. Which seems surprising today, but it just was not an issue at the time. No one was making those connections to think that was a bad thing to do. But when the second study was launched in 1958, the question was added. And the story goes that the somewhat eccentric scientist who ran that study, just as the very first questionnaires were about to be sent to the printers and sent out to the nation, raced in and said, "Stop. I absolutely must add a question about smoking in pregnancy," because he'd seen the very first sort of mutters about concerns about it in the medical literature. So the questionnaires were all called back at the last minute. The question was added, and then out they went. And many thousands of women across the country answered these questions about whether they smoked during pregnancy. So this it proved to be a very worthwhile delay, because what they were able to do was have much more detailed information on women's smoking habits in pregnancy. And also, of course, they collected all the information about the tragic stillbirths and infant deaths that happened in that group of children. Now, it wasn't until the 1970s that they actually went and crunched all of that data, because by this point there was a big debate about whether smoking in pregnancy caused harm to children. And the scientists were able to show convincingly that it was a problem. So they were able to show that women who had smoked during pregnancy were more likely to have children who were of slightly lower birth weight, and that this also increased the risks of infant mortality. And this was even when confounding factors such as social class or how many children a woman had was taken into account. And they published a very influential paper on this in 1972 in the British Medical Journal, which really convinced many scientists and doctors that this was a concern. And this poster that I'm showing you here was produced, a public health poster, as pretty much as a direct consequence of that study. And so it really went on to change public health advice that was given to women and establish this idea that obviously we have today that smoking in pregnancy is dangerous. So it's really been saving lives ever since, although there is still work to do. Around 12% of women today still smoke in pregnancy. So the final finding I want to talk about is really getting back to this theme I've already touched on about inequality. It's just a major theme throughout the book because it's emerged again and again when people have studied these groups of children. So in every cohort, it's been found that the children who have been born into disadvantaged circumstances have tended to follow a more difficult path. And by that I mean they've been more likely to struggle at school, as I had mentioned, more likely to struggle getting the good jobs. They've often suffered poorer health, amongst many other things. And there was one quite famous book, which I'm showing you here, on the children who were actually born into the most disadvantaged households of all in the 1958 generation. And they found that many of these were already suffering such difficult lives that they asked if these children were born to fail, which is quite a shocking phrase if you think about it. And this book actually became a surprise bestseller back in the early 1970s. Now, scientists have gone on to continue to explore this question in many ways. And one recent and particularly controversial study from the cohorts, this was in the 2000s, suggested that it was actually becoming harder for children to escape a difficult background, or in other words, that social mobility had declined. And the aim of that work was actually to examine the income of parents and then look at the income of their children when the children had grown up. And they would ask, basically, whether the poor children had stayed poor as adults or whether they had managed to better themselves. And the result came as a shock. It showed that the income of children born in 1970 was tied more tightly to the income of their parents than those who'd been born in the previous generation in 1958. So, in other words, it had become harder for these children born in 1970 to escape from their background. In the book, I say that poverty had become a stickier glue. Now, this finding is actually quite controversial. Some academics question whether it's correct or question whether this is an appropriate measure of social mobility because there are other ways to look at it. But it also ended up having quite an impact because it landed in the 2000s, just as the discussion that we're having about inequality was kind of taking off. And it helped drive some of today's political focus on improving social mobility and increasing life chances. So a lot of that discussion, this sort of idea that social mobility is in decline, some of that can be traced back to these studies. Now, I also think, it's not all doom and gloom. These studies have also struck something of a note of optimism by showing that actually children are not necessarily born to fail. Not everyone, as you know, born in difficult circumstances ends up in difficult circumstances. There are routes to escape. And scientists are working very hard to understand what those are. And evidence from these studies and many other places has pointed to the importance of parenting, actually, of parental interest and engagement with children, particularly in the first few years of life, and suggested that sort of interested, engaged parents might compensate to some extent for a disadvantaged start. So, for example, one study of disadvantaged children born in 1970 showed that those whose parents had read to them when they were five and who'd shown a real interest in their education when they were 10 were much less likely to be in poverty when they reached the age of 30. Now, that was rather a whistle-stop tour through four key findings: birth, schooling, smoking, and social mobility. And there is just so much more. I'm hard pushed to summarise the book in such a short time. But in my final section, I just do want to talk about a more human story. So by introducing you to one of the people who is in the studies. And that in some way takes us right back again, actually, to the beginning of this story. So in the book, I really wanted to include the stories of people who were in these studies. Now, the challenge is that their identities is confidential, of course, as it should be. But there are some people who are happy to reveal that they're cohort members. And I was able to talk to some of them and include their stories. And that was actually really interesting because you find that sometimes, their lives mirror the findings of the studies, but often they don't. And that's because these studies look at trends across the group, but they can't tell us what's going to happen or what will happen for an individual person. So perhaps my favourite story is about a woman called Patricia Palmer. And here she is as a 16-year-old. And she was born in 1946 in this first cohort. She was born at home in Cheltenham in the family bed with just a midwife to help her mother with the birth and no pain relief, all of which was very common at the time. As I explained earlier, this cohort study showed that working class women tended to receive worse medical care, and that was really true for Patricia's mother. She received the most basic care. Patricia was the fifth child born to her mother. She'd already had one stillborn child, and one of her children had already died, which was, again, very common then because infant and child mortality were much higher then than they are now. And Patricia faced a lot of disadvantages, so I think you could argue that she was born to fail. They were a working-class family. Her father drank. He gambled. He often didn't bring home any money for her mother. And then he left home when Patricia was five, and he died shortly after. So the family was left with very little money, and Patricia remembers very vividly being embarrassed because she wore third-hand clothes and she was the one who was having free school meals. Now, I mentioned that discovery from the 1946 cohort into which she was born that showed that working-class children were more likely to fail their 11-plus exam. Patricia failed her 11-plus. Now, she vividly, again, remembers the day of the exam. She thinks her teacher had written her off because he actually hit her on the day of the exam and left her trembling. And it was no surprise to her that she failed it. And perhaps even if she had passed, she wouldn't have gone to grammar school because her brother passed the 11-plus, but her mother couldn't afford to buy the blazer and cap and tie that was necessary for him to go to grammar school. Now, I also explained, of course, how these studies have shown that many children born into disadvantage tend to go on and struggle in life. But Patricia doesn't feel that did happen for her. She feels that she beat the odds. And for her, life turned out okay, partly because of chance, partly because she inherited a work ethic from her mother. She did well at secondary school. She went on to get various jobs. She ended up managing the finances for a large school. She had three children, and here she is in a nice photo with two of them. And I went to visit Patricia a couple of years ago, and I want to show you her today. She is now a friendly, lovely 70-year-old living on the outskirts of Cheltenham. She's very happy with how her life has gone. She's getting tired, picking up her grandchildren from school and, you know, going to the gym in the morning to stay healthy. And she also feels really proud for being part of this amazing study. And the main reason I wanted to tell you her story is just that it reminds us that ultimately these studies are about ordinary people like Patricia leading very ordinary lives, but that when you collect information on thousands and thousands of them over time, you end up with really, really valuable data for scientists, which hopefully allows them to begin to understand why people's lives in general tend to follow particular paths. Now, earlier this month, I went to the 70th birthday party of this group, of which Patricia is part, and here they are. They're really an amazing group of people. They feel, like Patricia, they just feel so special for being part of this study. It's really become part of their lives. And the cohort studies are just completely dependent on the goodwill of these people. You know, if they didn't take part and fill in the questionnaires, these studies would collapse. And it just seems remarkable to me that this group, that they're just entirely unruffled that these scientists want to follow them on and on until they die. But they feel like their mothers signed them up for this study and it's their duty to see it through to the last. So that's really all I have time to say. I've given you a small taste of the riches of these studies. I hope I've convinced you that amazing things happen when we do something as simple as track people through their lives, and that these studies have really produced a wealth of important findings, as well as being full of really fascinating human stories. So it's been a privilege and a pleasure for me to learn and write about these studies. And that's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope we've left plenty of time for questions.
Thank you for that, Helen. That really was a whistle-stop tour through an extraordinary amount of data. I would highly recommend this because it does cover all of life in one book. And it's really beautiful, the kind of narrative weaving of life history, so like Patricia, I think her name was, and then also the data and what the data did in terms of shifting policy, changing the way that we did things. I think that there's another story there about the eccentricity and the drama that underpins, I think you could say, the extraordinary lives of the scientists doing this. A line that you just think, you don't read a line like this in a book very often, so I'm just going to read it out, about one of the scientists, Dr. Barker. A few years ago, Barker wanted to find out about how the placentas in Bristol were doing, so he gave Davy Smith a call. I just thought, you don't hear that very often, but I was just wondering what was happening to that shed of placentas. So there is an array of data. It's not just the questionnaire data. You know, I am a bit squeamish. You're a science writer, so you're not remotely squeamish, but I found it quite interesting when there was talk of leaky ears and thawing out urine and a shed full of placentas. But I think it has had an enormous impact on health and health policy. You alluded to smoking, but what other kinds of areas did you see that this kind of cohort study really impacted?
Yeah, I think these studies are really interesting and actually quite unusual in the way that they bridge medical research and social science, and that was really interesting for me. My background's more in biological sciences and medical research. I want to explain the placentas, because I was wondering. But one of these studies, the one that started in the 1990s, was coming about just as scientists were becoming very interested in understanding the role of genes in health and disease. And they wanted to collect DNA from these children. But they actually went to town when it came to collecting tissues. So they've now just got this extraordinary basement in Bristol, which I was able to visit, full of just of DNA samples. They collected thousands of milk teeth from the children. There were fingernail clippings. There are hair samples, and they collected 9,000 placentas from the births, which they're yeah. storing. So that's you know, partly why it's been very important in medical research. So many, many studies just now, because they can follow the health of these people over time, then they can draw associations between, for example, their genetic sequence mm-hmm. and the health conditions that they develop. I mean, I can pull out one specific health finding if you want. I mean, one I talk about that I find really interesting is which... enables, well, one of the powerful things about these studies, having a series of them, is you can compare the generations. And a very interesting study that was done recently was just looking at obesity across the generations. So they just were able to collect up all the body weight measures for the five generations and see how they've changed over time. And when they did that, they discovered something really interesting. So the cohort that was born in 1946, childhood obesity just wasn't an issue. I mean, they were all, you know, brought up on rationing and running around outside. And in fact, obesity wasn't much of an issue at all until the 1980s, when all of the first three generations seemed to really start to gain weight. And then the generations that were born afterwards, for those, childhood obesity was an issue. So it seems like it sort of showed that something very remarkable happened in the 1980s that led to or fueled obesity. And people now think that that's really when we were having a very dramatic change to our lifestyles. And so people became more affluent, you know, more desk jobs, more driving around in cars, more eating out. So I think that really is one of the sort of powerful health findings which I like to pull out.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I did learn that I could never be a sort of geneticist or a scientist like that, because a bucket of milk teeth just... Anyway, we'll move on from that. It's interesting thinking about how this data is used, and thinking about that particular thing about obesity and what happened in the 80s, because as you alluded to, there was a cohort, the missing cohort in 1982, and what that might have shown in that particular change in societal behaviours. Can you tell us a bit more about the dramas around, you know, this plays back to the interesting ways that this cohort has been held together sometimes on a shoestring. But tell us about the conditions of keeping this research alive, and then what caused it to fail in 1982.
So these studies have always just been extraordinarily difficult to start and sustain. And that's because they are complicated and they are expensive and... you know, and they go on and on. It's a really hard sell to funders to say you want to track thousands of people for 80 years, and by the way, it's going to be really expensive. And also, by the way, it's going to show that many children are born into disadvantage and they follow difficult lives. I mean, that's kind of, you know, difficult to get people to support. And also, you know, funding, scientific funding is given out in blocks of 3 or 5 years, but these studies need to go on forever. So they always are just lurching from kind of, you know, one funding check to the next, even though their power isn't following people across their lives. And scientists, I mean, the characters in the book have just done all kinds of things to, you know, to keep them alive, including, you know, considering mortgaging their own houses and throwing birthday party. I mean, once they threw a huge birthday party for all of the cohort members at Alton Towers with, you know, free passes to get there on British Rail, and started charities and almost anything you can think of to get them going. But in the 1980s, anyone who was paying attention on the slide would have seen that the missing cohort, so if there had been the 12-year cycle had continued of 46, 58, 70, there would have been one in 1982. And there were extremely ambitious plans to start one that would have filled that gap. But, I mean, its downfall was partly that actually the scientists became overambitious. It was just so extraordinarily big and expensive and wanted to collect so much information that it became unfeasible. But it also was arising at a time when kind of the political climate for such studies was not conducive to it taking shape. So it was in the Thatcher years, there was a lot of feeling of antipathy towards social sciences, and then also the drama was that there was just a horrible falling out between the scientists involved. So all of these factors together meant that although this study was planned, it never actually got off the ground in the 80s.
No, it's fascinating. But it has been renewed a number of times since, and hopefully will be renewed again. It's interesting now that the you showed that picture of everyone having their 70th birthday party. Actually, where the first cohort is now is actually really of interest to policymakers. The ageing population is something that people are always talking about. And I think I'm really interested in how these insights might inform policy going forward or already have. I think you had alluded to in our earlier conversation about looking at different kinds of conditions and actually what that meant for what later life will look like in the future. Can you elaborate a little bit on how
you can argue really that these cohorts are becoming very important now in understanding the health of the ageing population. I mean, actually, that's how the scientists are positioning the cohort, which is 70 now. So they're doing very intensive studies to understand the ageing process. And so, just for example, one recent study they did, which was very simple, was just to, they did very detailed clinical exams of all of the cohort members when they were 65, and said, okay, well, how many out of a list of 10 clinical disorders, you know, blood pressure, diabetes, osteoporosis, has everybody got? And they found that people had 2 on average. But the interesting thing, perhaps it doesn't sound surprising, but many of these hadn't been diagnosed, actually. So it sort of really revealed what I call a potential tsunami of health disorders, which are coming with our ageing population. And in some ways, it also takes that study right back to the roots, because I mentioned at the beginning it was able to feed into the NHS and help shape the way that women give birth. And, you know, this is now acting as something of a sort of bellwether for the baby boom population and the ageing population, and showing us perhaps what we need to do to be able to cater for that group now.
So it's a fascinating story. I'll take some questions from the audience.
I'm proud to say that I'm part of the 58 cohort, and I'm delighted to continue to contribute. But you raised the question about willingness to contribute. We were all selected at random by being born in a certain week. Does the cohort remain random through life as people choose not to take part? How does this affect the data? Does it remain valid? How is it used? Yeah. Do you have to adjust for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm really pleased to meet you. Now, I've written this book, I meet cohort members everywhere. so obviously it doesn't necessarily remain completely random, that certain demographics, for example, might... I mean, for one thing, the people who are more healthy are going to stay involved and are more able to participate. So that does become an issue. And also, I think there is an issue, or can be an issue, with diversity in terms of maintaining participation from different social groups and different backgrounds. However, I mean, scientists have had to become very clever about this, is the way I see it, in that they have developed far more sophisticated statistical models, which are basically able to recognise where the gaps are and basically kind of fill in the missing data. So if you know that your population has become swung towards the middle classes, you can try and adjust for that to try and make sure that it remains representative. And also if you have a finding, you can go out and try and, you know, retest it in other ways to see that it's supported.
Thank you. I've just wanted to pick up on the most recent comments about your optimism about future studies at a time when we know government expenditure has been cut back and perhaps there are other sources of funding for these studies, but clearly a lot of money is needed. But given that the last cohort study was the year 2000, isn't it about time that we should be hearing about the next study, given we're now 2016? And do you have any reflections on the current political interests and appetite for continuing these studies? As you say, it's an international envy, and it seems to me we should know how best we can communicate to all those powers that be that these things need to continue.
Yes, I'm not necessarily optimistic about the future, and the reason is because so the next study was started and ended, so there's actually a very sad ending to this book. There should have been another cohort. It was planned from 2012, and it actually launched last year in 2015 in January, and the idea was to recruit 80,000 children. It was going to be the biggest and most ambitious of these cohorts and continue the series, and there was a lot of excitement around it. It launched in January. It was closed in October, and there's some dispute about why that has happened. For me, it meant desperately rewriting the end of the book, but, you know, the more important thing is that the study went down, so... Scientists are angry about it. So funders have argued that it was because women weren't signing up to the study. And it was true that they did have a low participation rate, and that is a big issue. It's to get people to take part today. It's much harder than it was when everyone did their bit after the war. But the scientists are angry, feeling that they weren't given a proper chance to get this study off the ground. So it's a bit complicated. But certainly that sort of made scientists worried that there are, that they're constantly concerned that they're not going to get the next funding check, and I don't think that this helped.
Thank you. My name's Nick Eubank. I'm part of a team that's just got funding from the Wellcome Trust to carry out some research looking at the impact of engaging in cultural activities on people's health and well-being. Arts and cultural activities of various kinds, participatory or pure consumption, mainstream activities rather than specific interventions designed to have a particular impact. Part of our team is the representatives of the HUNT project in Norway, which perhaps you're familiar with, which is similar range of longitudinal studies over gathered over time, but with a lot of lifestyle information included. And thinking about Michael Marmot's emphasis on a social model of health needing to emerge, and the whole aspect of people having being encouraged to develop meaningful lives that they value. Where do you think is there a place for culture and engagement in positive activities, either to emerge from the existing cohort studies or perhaps to be placed within future studies?
I think that information has been collected in these cohorts over the years. So there's reams of information. You should delve into the databases on social participation, on cultural participation. There's an absolutely brilliant collection of leisure diaries that were collected from the 1970 generation when they were teenagers in 1986, which almost recorded every single TV program they were watching at the time. And that information is only now, you know, being used. So I think that is there. And I also think this idea of, for example, in the first cohort, the 1946 born one, this idea of being socially engaged and so on, and their well-being, that's like a whole ream of research which is really taking shape now, reflecting the kind of growing interest in that. So I'm not sure they need much convincing that that's an important thing to do. And I suspect there's just so much information almost which hasn't, you know, fully been tapped. And the scientists are often just wanting, you know, they're trying to encourage people to come in and use this data in ways it hasn't been used before. So it might well be there for the taking.
It's the creation of what is it to look at that marriage of arts and yeah, science in the way that this book does, but actually maybe it's about creating new ways of researching. So good luck. Marie-Claude.
I'm Marie-Claude Gervais, and I have a special interest in health and health inequalities in particular. And it overlaps with the previous question, but how much information would be mineable in terms of ethnicity? Has that analysis been done across the various themes for how divergent or similar the patterns are over time for ethnic minority populations versus the white British mainstream kind of population?
So I think that information has been collected. I think that ethnic minorities were a very, very small part of certainly the first three cohorts, and it was really only in the millennium cohort that it became a major focus to have full representation of ethnic minorities, as far as I understand it. So I can't speak, you know, in detail to what data there is, but I think that it is there. You know, whether there's enough people in those populations and in the earlier cohorts to answer specific questions, that's what I'm not actually sure of.
Thanks. My name's Tom Schuller, and for a couple of years I ran a think tank called Longview, which tried to make the bridge between the cohort studies and other longitudinal studies in policy making. I really wanted to ask you to say a little bit more about the impact on policy making. I mean, you've described the richness of the data and the huge potential of the studies, but I would say overall, if you looked at the potential, the realization of the potential has been much less than it might have been. It's one of the things I had to wrestle with. And I'd like your reflections on that. Is it a question of the scientists not having been able to express their results in ways and through channels that were communicated to politicians, or the politicians were not willing to make the effort to understand the implications, or didn't like the potential results? Can I just make a couple of, on the political history? My understanding is actually it was a personal intervention from Mrs. Thatcher that stopped the 1982 cohort coming. But just in the interest of political neutrality, it has to be said, David Willetts has been a terrific supporter of cohort studies and really mobilised all that he could on the political side to support them. But this interaction between, you know, it's not necessarily the case that the richer the scientific study, the more the impact it has on policies. I mean, you track people through time, and even if you had one cohort, that's very rich. But as a huge added dimension, by being able to contrast, as you did in one of your examples, what's happened to different generations. And it doesn't always show progress. If I can just take one example, if you look at the gender pay gap, you can contrast the 1958 cohort and the 1970s cohort, and in the initial stages of the life course, it looks as if the gender pay gap has closed. As the cohorts get older, the pay gap opens up again, and by age about 50, it looks as if the pay gap is as big as it was, as big for the later generation as it was for the older generation. So those generational contrasts are really, really significant.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you know more about this than I do. Certainly I felt in learning about this story that the findings which made the most impact were not necessarily the most important ones or the most, you know, solid ones even. They landed at the right time when there was receptivity toward that message in policy and political circles. So, I mean, to go right back to the start, you know, everyone was able to feed into the NHS because the NHS was being formed. And I'm sure you've seen that later, is that, you know, sometimes it's just that politicians have turned their attention to that and this particular nugget of information lands and it suits that agenda. So I have actually been asked before this question of, like, how could there have been more impact made? And I haven't found a perfect answer to it because I think that that's very difficult. I mean, that's about the sciences in general engaging with the political process, right? I mean, some scientists... I did find it interesting just interviewing so many scientists that some are really willing to take their findings and completely engage with the policy process. And they were, you know, maybe moving into government or, you know, they really wanted to have a message. And often, you know, scientists don't see that as their role. And it's like, well, this is my data and now I'm done. So maybe that's something which scientists have to ask themselves is what impact they want and how best to achieve it.
Hi there. I'm actually another one of those people. I was part of 1970s kind of study, so it's really interesting. But I'm probably going to commit sort of huge heresy amongst a bunch of academics and social policy people. But what strikes me, I work in the world of marketing, and it strikes me that this type of data is incredibly helpful to, you know, the likes of Unilever and many, many other organisations in terms of product development and planning for ageing populations and those sorts of things. I mean, have you come across any sort of business-related applications of this data, or is that an area that they should maybe think about from a funding perspective and that sort of thing?
I haven't really, and I think that there are restrictions around the use of the data. So a lot of it from some of these cohorts is kept in a big data bank in Essex. And I believe that you can only use that data if you have, you know, a valid research hypothesis, and you won't use it for profit. So I think there would be, rightly, you know, restrictions, tight restrictions about how it's used, and obviously the confidentiality. I mean, whether there, you know, academics are always looking ways to interface with business if it gets them some money. but that's not something I particularly encountered, actually.
The toothpaste company is looking at your milk teeth. Do you want that to happen? That's the question.
You'd have to be so... Obviously, you have to be so careful. I mean, that would just be so difficult because, you know, you mustn't alienate people. You know, if people feel like their data's being sold, they're just going to say no, and the study is gone like that. So people are very, very cautious, rightly cautious about that.
There are interesting questions about how people understand their own privacy of data, though, now, and how you might recruit new cohorts as technology changes and people feel differently.
Well, I think that was an issue which was discussed when this new study went down. You know, why is it hard to get people to engage in these studies today? And there are, you know, understandably, there's much more concern about... giving away your data and your child's data to a big study, which is going to track them through their lives, right? I mean, today, that doesn't sound so attractive. In 1946, giving consent just involved, you know, inviting the health visitor into your house, and that was it. So it's a bit more complicated now.
Absolutely.
Has there been any discussion of the use of a single week in March as the basis? Because you don't need to be an astrologer to feel that people in September might get a better chance out of life than people born in June.
Yeah. Right, that's a really good question. And the original choice of the week, you might think it was carefully planned, but it wasn't. It was just that the founder of this first study, James Douglas, decided that if he did it in March, then he could recruit a bunch of summer students to sort of code the data on the cheap afterwards. And then it was just copied. But anyway, the 1 week only was for the first three studies, and it was realised that that was an issue because obviously you can't study month of birth effects, which is what you're talking about, which are very real. And so the 1990s study has spanned over a year, and the Millennium study spans about a year and a half, I think, or 2 years. And it's allowed them to ask questions such as, for example, why is it that summer-born children tend to do worse on certain academic measures? And that's actually proved to be really useful, is to expand the range of time across which these children are born.
It's been really fascinating to hear the potential of this. I mean, it seems that there is still huge potential for this study, not just for ageing population, but also to play to that thing about demographics and understanding the shifting, the face of Britain. I think it was quite interesting that the mandate for this was to avoid the elimination of the British people or something that you said. I'm misquoting you there, but it seemed very like a kind of call to arms to the start of it. And it's interesting to see what its evolution will be. Do you have any sense of where next? You know, the cohort wasn't realised now, but what would be the ideal future scenario for the future of the cohort studies?
I mean, I've hinted at one way. It's just moving into the future, which is, again, just adapting with the times and understanding how people are ageing. My sense is that there's still some kind of soul-searching as what went wrong with the last one. You know, in an ideal world, I mean, so after that missing cohort of 1982, there was a pause, but then kind of scientists again recognised actually this is quite a good thing to do and maybe we should, you know, get the series going. So you might hope that perhaps, you know, once the wound over this one is healed, that maybe history would repeat again and that there would be some way to launch, you know, the next in the series. But it might be that there needs to be a really radical rethink of how that's done. I mean, you know, One thing that's become interesting is that we can start to do, in some ways, cohorts on the cheap, because so much data is collected about us now anyway, that in some ways, if you get people to give their consent at birth, their parents to give consent, you know, you can just sort of scrape up all this information from medical records, from, you know, educational records, from tax records and so on. And other studies are actually starting to incorporate that, again, with consent. So there may be ways to just do it in a different way, enable to follow people over their lives. Mm.
But whether it has that kind of tangible quality of the human life, which I think is really nicely illustrated. You know, you illustrate in this book very, very data-driven analyses of things like air pollution, but then also with the human story of the, you know, discharge from the ear from a child, you know. So it's a much better story than that. That's a really horrible illustration. I'm slightly traumatised still by some of these things. But it's really showing that actually collecting data about life and through lives really gives us a huge array of data that can go off in many, many different directions. I think it was a worthy endeavour that you took to try and work out how it could have multiple impacts, you know, and I think that that's something that this data should continue to do. But it's been really fascinating talking to you. Thank you for joining us here at the RSA today. So please join me in thanking Helen Pearson.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.